It's half past the hour on a winsome Wednesday morning here along the Broken Road. David Allen Putt is in the newsroom there behind the news desk, ensconced comfortably in his soft brown Corinthian leather-covered news chair. That's the one that goes up and down and round. You should watch him in between news ruminations. He has more fun in the newsroom. And we're joined this morning.
And now my camera is zooming back in and back out.
he's discovered new settings on his video camera.
Wow.
Yeah, he's zooming around. It's following his face wherever he goes, and he just lights up. Okay. All right. I'll get used to that probably. We're joined, too, by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie is an Anglican pastor and hangs out a lot in Leesburg, Virginia, and points east, right? You're almost at the hub of the nation there in Washington, D.C. And of course, I don't know Leesburg, though. That's the northern extreme of Virginia, isn't it? Is it a nice, quiet place?
And
it is
west.
And a little bit west, too. Yeah.
Well, good morning. It's good to be with you. Yeah, we're hanging out in Leesburg, about 45 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. So it's a long walk from Alexandria, where we were before this pandemic.
Farther than I thought, 45 minutes. Okay. Is it a rural setting in Leesburg? Is anything rural out there? I remember the Shenandoah Valley is. That's beautiful. But
sure. Around Percival, Leesburg, there's definitely more rural settings. But where I am in Ashburn is where I live, and it's more suburban.
Okay.
Looks a lot like a planned community like Reston, Virginia, or similar.
So you got neighbors and security fences or privacy fences around the houses, do you?
So nobody. Not quite. I'm in a townhome community, and we don't have any fences.
Just
trails and lakes, and it's beautiful. Beautifully landscaped and well-organized neighborhood.
Robbie is a huge fan of biblical archaeology, and probably just archaeologically oriented wherever it happens to be, but he brings so much to us. He's also a member of the board at Preserving Bible Times, and so much of what we talk about relates to biblical context. And today I threw a whole bunch of different topics at Robbie over the past week, and he was preparing for them all when I said, well, I'm thinking, choose one. And he's prepared for it. We can go anywhere. So I think what we're going to do is go to Nazareth. Little dinky village. Well, it used to be a little dinky village up in the Galilee region of Israel. And history goes way, way back. And the thing is about biblical history, so much of what we know comes from tradition as well as valid historical artifacts. Now, Robbie has alerted me to all the archaeological research that's going on. I'll get used to it. And one of the things that disturbs me is I was reading reports of how ISIS in Iraq is busy destroying historical sites and artifacts, although they're making money off those artifacts as well. I know you were at the Museum of the Bible for some time, and I know that places like the British Museum and the French Louvre since the 19th century has been taking stuff in that a lot of people would consider thievery. But now that so much is being destroyed of what's left in Iraq, Iraqi citizens are glad you've got them in London and in France and probably at the Museum of the Bible, too, because there are thousands of artifacts that are now protected that otherwise would be lost. Tell us a little bit about the Museum of the Bible, how you got there, and the kinds of artifacts that are there. I think of just the history of the book, the Bible itself, or is it Christian history?
Well, a little bit of both. We have at Museum of the Bible is 430,000 square feet of museum. It's opened in November 17th, 2017. And it was a traveling exhibit, the Passages exhibit, which was a traveling museum of artifacts and books, biblical manuscripts dating back all the way to the 500 AD, and even some scrolls that were older than that. So this traveling exhibit, when I was teaching Bible in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, at a Christian school called Kiskaya Christian School, I was researching the Green Collection through the Passages exhibit and just discovered a wealth of resources through the Christian school curriculum and some of the professional development that that I was doing, and was excited that my home base back in the United States was Washington, D.C. So I was looking forward to visiting the museum. I had no idea that I would move to Alexandria, Virginia a year before the opening of the museum, and ended up being on the inaugural docent class and even a living history interpreter there. The museum staff discovered that I knew a little bit about biblical context and archaeology, and they roped me in to help write the talking points for the living history interpreters and the recreation of the village of Nazareth on floor three, the narrative floor. The museum has six floors above ground, two in the basement, and the museum is divided into three major sections: the history, the narrative, and the impact floors. And so I spent most of my time on Friday afternoons on the narrative floor, where there's a recreation village of Jesus of Nazareth.
That's astounding to me. Now I want to go there. I try to avoid crowded places, you know, and I think of Washington, D.C. as such. But the history of Nazareth is so fascinating. It is not mentioned in the Old Testament. And the assumption is it didn't exist in Old Testament days. And from what I have discerned, what I've gleaned from my own reading, is that it was probably founded sometime in the intertestamental period, probably with the fourth wave of refugees that came from Babylon back into Israel. And if people have read about the initial wave, which was under Artaxerxes of Persia, he said, "Oh, come on back to Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, let's get reestablished." And some people did, but not a whole lot of them. A lot of people hung back in Babylon and waited for a time when Jews would be governing Jews. And that didn't happen until about 140 BC, something like that. And so a wave of refugees, or I guess you'd call them immigrants, came from Babylon along the Euphrates River. And it's about a four-month trek. It's an arduous journey and not a safe one. So they would have come in caravans in large groups. And there was part of that wave that was of the Natzur clan, excuse me, N-A-T-Z-U-R is the way we spell it. And some historians think, see if I can get my voice back here, that the name Nazareth comes from Natzur, which was that clan, and the meaning of the word is branch, like a branch on a tree, or maybe like a clan branch. In other words, an offshoot, an ancestor, offshoot from a Natsur clan, and it was founded on a cliff, a high rise, in Galilee, overlooking the Jezreel Valley of all places. To think that Jesus would have spent his youth there, overlooking Armageddon.
Indeed. So the Jezreel Valley, as you stand on that brow of the cliff, and it literally is a brow, and it's mentioned in Luke's gospel when they're trying to run Jesus out of town and stone him. And they push him to that brow of the cliff, the same cliff he probably would have played along that cliff face as a kid, overlooking. You can see Carmel in the south and the west of there. You can see where Jesus' Nain on the south and the east of there, where Jesus raised the widow's son. On the other side of the mountain from where Elisha raised a widow's son. Mm-hmm. So you can see all of this. And again, yeah, Megiddo, where many believe the last battle will be fought right there in Jezreel Valley. You can look over that Jezreel Valley and see Megiddo in the distance. So yeah, lots of rich history there. And you don't just stumble across Nazareth. You don't go through there on accident. You have to intend to do it. There's no real trade routes through there, and because of that high brow of the cliff, it's almost topographically, it's almost like a bowl.
Well, in the time Jesus was there, it was an insignificant little place. And historians, and I know there's a divergence of opinion among historians, there always are, and that's good because it makes us think and research other alternatives. But some would say there were as few as 20 families living in Nazareth. They would have had a synagogue probably toward the center of town. And you mentioned Jesus' presentation at the synagogue, which so riled those people they wanted to kill him. Some would say that they didn't because, you know, and Luke, it just says he went through the crowd and left. But that brow of the hill you mentioned is actually a mile away from where the synagogue would be, and it was too far to walk on a Sabbath. So they couldn't actually do that. It was more of a threat, more huff and puff, than actual intent to kill. But those are some of the different facets of that story that are so interesting to look at. You played a character, speaking of the Museum of the Bible, a living history character, and his name was?
Eli. When there was another Eli in the village, I would be Samuel. And then there was Jeremiah, named after the prophet Jeremiah, that worked in the synagogue. So I worked in an unfinished home across from the synagogue. And the elder of the synagogue would work the synagogue. We had a woman of the village who would be in the home. Mm-hmm. And there would be days where we might have one man in the village, and I would play the elder and the carpenter or tecton in the unfinished home.
So you were you were very versatile, is what you were.
had to be. So we learned the village, and it had pretty much everything that Nazareth would have had, including a recreation of the synagogue. Ours was scaled down, of course, to fit inside the third floor of the museum, but it was modeled off of the synagogue found in Magdala, because they have not actually discovered the synagogue ruins in Nazareth.
Well, Nazareth now is a fairly sizable city. I mean, there's lots of places built on top of the old locations, and you can't just go dig in those places. So it really restricts what kind of archaeological research can be done. So your living history experience. Eli, what brought you to Nazareth to begin with? Joseph and Mary and you and sister and brothers? All in what? How'd you live? What was the house like?
Shalom. Welcome to Nazareth. My name is Eli. I'm one of the master builders here. Carpenter, tecton. Building with stone mainly. I grew up here in the village.
Carpenter or craftsman? Is that a misnomer, carpenter? Because I think of working in wood. There's not a lot of wood around here.
Ah, yes, the cedars of Lebanon, but we do not work with wood as we work with stone here. The limestone, it is easy to chisel. It is much different than the basalt stone down by Capernaum. It is black in color. It is volcanic rock.
It's customary, is it not, to follow your father's trade? Is that how you came to be a carpenter or a craftsman?
Ah, yes, I have inherited my tools from my father. And he inherited tools from his father, and I, when my son is old enough, I will teach him the trade.
How do you make a living outside of craftsmen? And where do you find work? What do you build? What kinds of things do you do?
There is no shortage of work here in Nazareth. We are all helping each other build the home, and it can take upwards of months, maybe a year, to build this home. Depending on the crops, and we have to stop the building to harvest the crops. Everyone does everything in Nazareth.
Homes, many of them actually carved out of the rock. Is that true?
Ah, yes, yes. The stone, you see. First, we dig down to the foundation. You do not want to build your home upon the sand. The foundation is laid. It is there. We dig down to it. It is the limestone, and we set the stone, the cornerstone. And from the cornerstone, we lay the stone, using the plumb line and, of course, the measuring line, laying out the stone very carefully upon the solid bedrock.
Looking far into the future, Nazareth will be known someday, back in the future in 2019, as the Arab capital of Israel. Was it like that when you were there? Or is it like that now?
I have heard rumor of a man named Nathaniel speaking ill of Nazareth. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? You know why he says it. There is no mention of Nazareth in the prophets and the law. They say, can anything good come out of Nazareth? But good things come from Nazareth. We have the stone, we have the millstone, we have olives. We are making olive oil from the olives, the mikveh, the synagogue, the crops, the fields, the vineyards. You see, we have a vineyard off in the distance, and there is a watchtower. But there is no mention of a prophet ever having come from Nazareth. So they say, can anything good come out of Nazareth? But good things come from Nazareth. It means branch or shoot. You know, the prophets of old.
Do you know anybody in the wine business?
Ah, yes, we make wine. We crush the grapes with our feet. There is a wine press in the distance. There you can see it, carved out of the limestone. The limestone does not hold the impurities, you see, like the clay jars that you see here.
Ah, okay.
The ceremonial washing jars, we carve them out of the solid stone. Hmm. It is not made by hand. We carve them out of what the Lord has made.
Mm-hmm. What kind of technology does it take to cut stone in that day and time? What kind of tools would you use to cut a stone?
Do you know that King David would lose the battles in the days of old and before him because of the bronze swords? But now we have iron, and it is very hard, and we can chisel the limestone.
I have a question that goes back before Nazareth then, because it's my understanding that David, in his time as a guerrilla leader, spending time in Gath with the Philistines, actually learned iron technology, which he brought back as king of Israel, and gained parity militarily with the Philistines, and the Philistines were heard from no more. Is that true?
Ah, yes, the Philistines. Seafaring people. You know, us Jews, we believe that the sea is evil. It is representative of evil itself. And those Philistines came from the sea, settled the coastal plains. But yes, David the brave king, he fought Goliath with a stone, a sling. He was a shepherd boy, and we raised sheep here, but mainly in Bethlehem of Judea, and some of our clan's people are from Bethlehem of Judea as well.
But I do know that that David took Goliath's sword back to his tent and admired it for
its, not just
as a weapon, but the technology involved. Was he not fascinated with iron technology even at that point as a young David?
Because their swords would break our bronze swords, you see. But we have used this technology over the last hundreds and hundreds of years. And now we have steel chisels, and we chisel 4 miles north of here is Sepphoris. And there is plenty of work in Sepphoris for a stonemason such as myself, a tecton, a master builder. Yahweh himself is a great master builder. In the beginning was the word. The earth was without form and void, and darkness covered over the face of the earth. And the Spirit of Yahweh hovered over the face of the earth. And God spoke, and there was something from nothing, light from darkness. He is the first master builder, and we build because we are made in the image of a maker.
Interesting, interesting, interesting. Nazareth was a small village, now a big city, and we're learning more about it yet. Archaeologists pouring over wherever they can pour over there. If we can snap back to the present day.
Indeed.
what does archaeology contribute to us now? I mean, we've got the Bible. What more do we need?
Ah, the land speaks. And we can find many things that are verifying the scriptural narrative. Things when Jesus, if Jesus grows up in Nazareth as a carpenter, and he knows how a house is constructed, setting stone upon the solid bedrock, limestone. He knows this when he teaches at the Sermon on the Mount, when he says, a wise man is the man who hears the word and does it. It's Shema, listen. To the Jew, to listen means to do. If you have not done, you have not heard. To us Westerners, we think it's our inner ear, our bones vibrating that, yeah, I heard you. But until you've actually responded to the thing that's been said, you have not listened. So when Jesus says that a wise man is like a man who builds his house upon the stone, when the winds come and the rains beat upon that house stands great and strong, does it stand? But the foolish man is the man who builds his house on the sand. This person is the one who hears, but he doesn't put the word into practice. So Jesus is equating this teaching, what everyone knows that to listen is to do, Shema. He's equating that with the building practices. And everybody knows you would never build your home upon the sand. These heavy stones, you have to dig down to the foundation, set your stones on the solid bedrock right beneath the surface. The bedrock was close to the surface of the ground. And that's why we have these archaeological remains to this day. This is why you can see a partially finished house in Nazareth, and why the wine press in the village of Nazareth, which is a 3-acre, 4-acre farm in Nazareth, a recreation of the first century village, they actually have a first century wine press there. So when you talk about treading the grapes and making wine, these things exist. Similar to Naboth's vineyard, there is a wine press carved out that has been discovered when Jezebel comes and takes Naboth's vineyard. And we can find these things, and they validate the scriptural narrative.
They prove the historicity of the Bible. And I was always fond of Doug Greenwald used to be with us every week on the air, and we learned so much from Doug. And one of the things he insisted upon was that the land is the fifth gospel.
That's right.
And people who have been there know that. And so many want to go and can't. And now with the pandemics and the political situation, I imagine that tourism is down somewhat, but still a lot of people eager to go and eager to go again and again and again. There must be something very captivating about being there, walking in the footsteps of Jesus and the people you read about in the Bible that just opens eyes. Now, you mentioned there needs to be that this was the nature of the Jewish people, that even the word believe wasn't just I'll ascend to something, assent to it intellectually. It was you live it. That's what belief meant. It was a very tangible, very simple approach to life. And it reminds me of the basic gift of salvation from the Lord Jesus Christ. It's offered to you, but it means nothing until you receive it, until you react to it. And how Jewish that whole notion is. It just sounds like logic to us, I think. But it was to have it built into you as a culture. The Jews are such a gift to us in what they've given us.
Indeed. I mean, and Jesus quoted, he tells the story about the two sons. There was a man who had two sons. One, he said, go do this. And he said, I'll do it. But he went and didn't do the thing. And then another son said, I will not do this. And then he went and did the thing his father said. Jesus poses the question, which one of these sons does the will of the father? And he said, of course, the one who did it. So it doesn't matter what you say, it matters what you do.
Amen to that. Talking with Pastor Robbie Pruitt, and hopefully we can do this frequently, maybe every... I haven't pressed Robbie too much on this, because he's got a full plate there in Virginia. But we so appreciate the time you've given us the last couple of Wednesdays, and hope we can continue, at least when it works out for you. We'll look forward to seeing you next time. Robbie Pruitt, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to be with you all. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Good to see you,
Robbie.
Dave.
Good to see you.